I will work day in and day out.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
We want to return to the European Union.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Vinnan, professor at King's College London, and author of a great new book that's recently been released, Second City, Birmingham and the Forging of Modern Britain. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you want to write a book about the history of Birmingham?
Well, it's always slightly odd to say why one writes a book, and one always gives kind of retrospective answers that are more coherent than the reality at the time. But obviously, partly because I grew up in Birmingham. I mean, I'm from Birmingham. My mother is still living in Birmingham. We still have a family house my sister and I grew up in. I felt a certain kind of affinity with it because of that. I felt that it would be interesting to write something that was a long way from what I'd written in the past, so that I wanted to write something partly that would kind of have a sense of place. I wanted to write something which I imagined would draw on things that I would know from having grown up in Birmingham, although mainly what I found, of course, was there are all sorts of things that I didn't really know about Birmingham, in spite of having grown up in there. And I wanted to write about Birmingham partly because it's seen as such an unfashionable place, and because I feel that there's always a kind of air of condescension when people talk about it. So I was particularly struck by the way in which it became important to the Conservative Party in recent years, especially, I think, post-Brexit referendum years, mm-hmm. where it's seen as this kind of, you know, oh, Birmingham is real England. And so most famously, of course, Theresa May makes her speech about, you know, if you're a citizen of the world, you come from nowhere, which she makes in Birmingham. It's a speech that's written by Nick Timothy, who's a very self-conscious Birmingham person. And I felt this is a very strange way to see Birmingham, which, of course, is a place of migration throughout its history. The whole point about people in Birmingham is almost all of them come from somewhere else, and a place of change. So I wanted to write about it partly to kind of capture that. And also wanted to write a history that would be unsentimental. So I think a lot of local history, especially local history of Birmingham, in fact, tends to work on the assumption that, you know, you've got to like the place you're writing about. And I don't think there's any reason why historians have to like the place they're writing about. So there are things about Birmingham I like, and there are things about Birmingham I don't like. And I think it would be crazy to write a history of Birmingham that didn't in some ways recognize there are some rather troubling bits of Birmingham's history.
And of course, Birmingham's history is one that is intertwined to a large degree with the Industrial Revolution. But of course, the book starts long before that, with the emergence of Birmingham from the Anglo-Saxon period. You mentioned the foundational mythos as to how Birmingham got its name, but of course, until the Industrial Revolution, until the Enlightenment, Birmingham was perhaps not the premier place in the Midlands that it is now seen as today. Could you just give it an explanation as to what, if someone listening was transported back to Birmingham at the turn of the 16th century, what they would have seen there? Because then it was quite a small place, relatively speaking, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it's small, you're right, until I suppose the 18th century, and then kind of yo-yoing up a bit after that. So I mean, the title of my book, Second City, actually Birmingham is only the second city in England from 1911 onwards. Mm-hmm. So Birmingham is transformed by two things, really, partly by people moving into it, which they're doing certainly as early as the 16th century, and also by the fact that Birmingham itself is moving, in the sense the kind of city limits are being pushed out all the time. So in 1911, there's a big expansion of the city limits, and that's the point at which it becomes the second most populous city in England. Before then, I mean, in some ways, it's very hard to capture what Birmingham's like before a certain point, because one of the things about the town as it then was, the city eventually, is that there's not an enormous amount of kind of architectural continuity. So, you know, you can walk around the Strand where my office is in London, and quite quickly you can see buildings that would date back a very long time. You can see a kind of street pattern in the city of London that would date back a long time. And you can see geographical features that define the city, which obviously haven't changed. So, you know, the River Thames and so on. It's much harder to capture that. Much harder to capture that kind of thing in Birmingham. So, I remember when I was growing up, two things that strike me in retrospect. One of which is, I can remember my mother talking about when she first moved to Birmingham. So this would have been just where I was born, early 60s, and she sort of said, "Well, you know, a bit south of our house, it used to be just fields, and this was entirely kind of built up by the time I was old enough to be conscious. It's 5 or 6 years later." So the city's physically changing a lot. And the other thing I remember very strikingly, I mean, this is going back before the 16th century, is at school we had a rather kind of ritualistic learning about Birmingham at primary school. Mm. It's sort of Northfield Manor, just kind of an area kind of equidistant between the university and what used to be the Longbridge car factory, very kind of socially interesting area. But so we used to have this kind of ritualistic thing where we'd learn about Birmingham's entry in the Domesday Book, and this would be the first appearance of Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And it was only when I wrote this book that I suddenly realized, actually, Northfield, the area around where I grew up, was a separate settlement from Birmingham, of course, at the time of Domesday, and was bigger than Birmingham. So, you know, Birmingham's kind of absorbing areas that are slightly autonomous around it up until that stage. But 16th century, it's still, I mean, little more really than a kind of industrial village. You know, you could name all sorts of places around Britain that would have been bigger than Birmingham at that time.
The change, as you mentioned, comes later during the 18th century. What drove that change, do you think? And to what extent was it reflective of Britain's expanding influence around the world, of the growth of the British Empire and the impact that then had on locations around Britain, which previously had been relatively small settlements, suddenly became much more important because of increased trade and the need for increased manufacturing capacity as well?
Those are hard questions to answer. So Birmingham doesn't have a kind of obvious single advantage in terms of natural resources or in terms of location or anything like that. So in a lot of the 20th century, in fact, central government planners think Birmingham's too kind of prosperous for its own good. They think too many people are moving to Birmingham, it's too crowded, and they want, particularly in the interwar period, then again in the 50s and 60s, they want to move industry to what they see as underdeveloped areas, to the north, to Wales, places like that, or not so much underdeveloped, depressed, declining areas. And one of the problems they have is they actually can't see why people have come to Birmingham in the first place. They can't see why industry is in Birmingham in the first place. They can't see it having any natural advantages. So I think it's a very kind of complicated economy, which depends quite a lot on people. Particular families, very important, the development of industrialization in Birmingham. Some people would say it's dependent partly on religion, that Birmingham is a particularly welcoming place to nonconformists and particularly to some quite small kind of nonconformist sects, especially the Unitarians, who are never very numerically big in Birmingham, but very economically and politically influential. I don't think that is in itself a kind of terribly plausible argument. I mean, I don't think, although it's true that Birmingham doesn't have the kind of institutional Anglicanism that a lot of other towns have, I think it's more that Unitarians move to the city and therefore the town, and therefore other Unitarians kind of follow them. And I think Birmingham is very much a kind of entrepot place. It's a place where people meet from other places, and a place where it derives importance from its relations with other places. So its relations with the Black Country, where there are natural resources. Its position, I suppose, is a rather kind of central point where trade can meet, those kind of things. But it's quite a hard economy to pin down. And I think one of the things that happens quite a lot now is there's a sense that you know, economic success must be something you can kind of put in a bottle and label. There's a kind of magic solution you can find. I don't think Birmingham provides that kind of magic solution. The second part of your question, to relate to the British Empire, well, it obviously relates quite a lot from the 18th century onwards to globalization. Mm-hmm. So people like Bolton, big Birmingham industrialist, are selling their products all over the world, very kind of conscious of doing that. It relates to empire, and I suppose the thing that one especially associates with the early stages of empire now, slavery, mm-hmm. in quite complicated ways. So on the one hand, Birmingham is full of people who are opponents of slavery. So the Unitarians and the Quakers, both, as I say, small but very influential groups in the kind of Birmingham grand bourgeoisie, they're almost invariably opposed to slavery. But of course, they do all sorts of business that in practice means they're economically benefiting from slavery. So notably, I mean, most ludicrously, the richest family in Birmingham at one time are the Gortons, who are Quakers, and they're gun manufacturers. And they have this sort of wonderful collection of moral justification. So they say, although they're Quakers and they're against violence, violence is going to happen. So people need guns. And then a lot of these guns, in fact, very cheap, useless guns, are taken to West Africa and traded with local chieftains for slaves. So again, the Gortons are really very heavily implicated in the slave trade. But it's not directly implicated in the way that, say, Liverpool or Bristol would be. Mm. It's not a port city, which has those very kind of direct links. And it's also, I suppose, later on, not a place that's administratively linked to the empire in the way that London or parts of Scotland, for example, are. So it's not a place where, you know, lots of people are going out to work for the Indian Civil Service. So you see Birmingham as a place where the empire is seen in very sort of brisk economic terms. Mm-hmm. You know, the key question is, can we flog these people things or can't we? And when there's a man called Tiptoft, a mayor of Birmingham at one time, who makes a great sort of tour of the empire in the 1930s, and he's utterly uninterested really in what people might see as the glamorous aspects of empire or empire as an adventure or empire as a political project. What he really wants is just, you know, can I make money out of these different places I'm visiting?
And of course, any discussion of the history of Birmingham would not be complete without mentioning the influence of the Chamberlain family, mm-hmm. and how they were, important, not just in politics in Birmingham, but British politics at the time in general. What do you think it was about Joseph Chamberlain that especially made him stand out as an incredible figure in 19th century politics, such an important figure in 19th century politics? And how much importance do you think his relationship with Birmingham was to his rise in the ranks of politics?
I think he's very important. Rather unlike the people I've just been describing, he's a kind of ideological imperialist, or he becomes one.
Yeah.
So he comes to think the empire is very important and obviously leaves this kind of Chamberlain legacy, both through his own two sons, Austin and Neville, and through people like Leo Amery, another Birmingham MP, who's very much a kind of Chamberlain, Joseph Chamberlain protege. All of whom are really the kind of last throw, I think, of trying to make the British Empire into something that's going to be slightly different in the 20th century and that they think up until the Second World War is going to survive. So I think in those ways, the Chamberlains generally are important. I think Joseph Chamberlain, very different from his sons in this respect, is just a mind-bogglingly extraordinary individual. And maybe he'd have been mind-bogglingly extraordinary anywhere he'd gone. So he arrives in Birmingham at the age of 18, I think, coming from London. And so although one kind of, you know, thinks he's almost synonymous with Birmingham, really there's a particular part of his life, the kind of period of his adult business career where he's very intertwined with Birmingham, and then this quite brief period where he's Lord Mayor of Birmingham, and then he becomes more of a national politician. I think the reasons why Birmingham kind of ties up with Chamberlain are partly, I think, there's this high point of Unitarianism. Chamberlain's a Unitarian. He's very much associated with other Unitarian families, especially the Kenricks. So his first and second wife are both Kenricks. And the Kenricks are a slightly more kind of subdued, less flamboyant group of people. But they're very important as providing a kind of support network for first Joseph Chamberlain and then his sons. They provide him with contacts. They kind of run things at local level politically while the kind of Chamberlains are away in London being national politicians. I think most of all what's striking about Joseph Chamberlain, though, is... And the thing I like about him, although I think in some ways he's a terrible person, the thing that's hard not to admire about him is his total contempt for the English establishment. So that everything you think about England, which is Anglicanism, now, Chamberlain's not an Anglican, and he's not, after the death of his second wife, probably a religious believer at all. Now, this is mind-boggling when you consider that he becomes effectively a conservative, becomes in many ways one of the great conservative kind of heroes that people now like Nick Timothy look back on. You think this man who's working with the third Marquess of Salisbury, working with this kind of arch high Tory conservative, doesn't believe in God. He's a Republican in his early career. So I appeared on Radio 4 on Start the Week the day after the Queen died, which was like being on Soviet radio after Chernenko died, something, you know, we all had to do our solemn voices. But I said... rather flippantly, you know, can I say Joseph Chamberlain was a Republican? And they said, hell no. And so I thought, this man is taking positions in the 1860s that are regarded as too radical for Radio 4 in 2022. He is contemptuous of the aristocracy. You know, he just laughs at the idea that he himself might take an aristocratic title. Although he works with aristocrats kind of when it suits him, he represents a completely different kind of world. And he's very much a man who believes in being kind of self-made. I think a very important quality for some people in Birmingham, which is not always something that makes them nice people. I mean, they're tough, they're ruthless. They're often rather contemptuous, I think, of people who they see as not being capable of making their own way in the world. But on the other hand, in Chamberlain's case, I think very much his sense is, you know, he's pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He has no particular time for the kind of hereditary ruling class. And I think also something that's important about Joseph Chamberlain and important about this whole network of people around it. So this will be true about the Kenricks, true about the Beales, another Unitarian family with whom inevitably Chamberlain's intermarried, true about the Cadburys, or the Cadburys are Quakers, not Unitarians, is that... they are people who have an interest in money that they see as useful for things they can do with it, which are sometimes, in fact, philanthropic things. So they all give away quite a lot of their money, and they all devote quite a lot of their time to doing things other than making money. So Chamberlain, having made quite a significant fortune quite early in life, then just kind of walks away from it and becomes a politician. And I think in that way, Birmingham's different from... obviously London, but also Liverpool, Glasgow, places more associated with trade, with shipping than with industry, where fortunes are larger, but where people become kind of possessed by their fortunes. You know, they have to kind of go on making money because being rich is itself an expensive thing. And so there's a whole world of kind of, you know, yachts, grouse moors and hunting lodges and sending your boys to eat, which begins to suck all the rest of the British industrial classes into being kind of pseudo-aristocrats. And I think Birmingham is unusually resistant to that. I mean, if you're at Warwick, you must have been to Birmingham occasionally.
Yeah.
And I was always very struck by the importance of Edgbaston, this kind of leafy suburb, which is actually very close to the centre of Birmingham. And most of the big families stay in Edgbaston for most of the 19th century. And, you know, they don't want to move out by a grand country house.
Mm-hmm. Something that is important during this period for many, even though in terms of television it was depicted somewhat later in Birmingham's history, are the gangs, referred to as the Peaky Blinders, but there were of course other gangs that were active in Birmingham in the late 19th century. What do you think of the way that the kind of gangs were portrayed in the television series Peaky Blinders? how accurate do you think it is to the actual activities of the kind of gangs that were active in Birmingham during the late 19th century, early 20th century? And what do you think we can reflect on in terms of thinking of, modern issues with gang culture and youth violence, looking back at how the Victorians dealt with it and how it arose then and what the causes were of it during the late 19th century, early 20th century, as compared to the causes of it today?
I'm a disadvantage when it comes to Peaky Blinders, because I think it's such a bloody awful series. I've never been able to watch very much of it. First of all, I think it tells you a lot about television and a lot about the extraordinary capacity of television to kind of praise itself. Of course, one of the big things about Birmingham in recent years is that although the BBC is very solemn about, getting out to the provinces and presenting programmes in Birmingham, they've actually closed down all their studios in Birmingham. And the only programme that's still made in Birmingham, as far as I can see, is that famous story of rural folk, The Archers. I don't think Peaky Blinders is realistic. There is a series made in the 70s, which I've never been able to get a full sequence of, but which you can pick up little bits of on YouTube, called Gangsters, which has always struck me as much more kind of edgy and interesting. I mean, it's obviously set in the time. It's something that deals with kind of Birmingham immigration, partly filmed in the Rum Run and the nightclub where famously Duran Duran started. And I always assumed that Gangsters is also the origin of that great Warwick Coventry band, The Specials. Of course, their first big hit is Gangsters. Peaky Blinders, I mean, the television programme is ludicrous, as far as I can tell from my very brief excursions into trying to watch it, it's a bit of The Godfather, like all bloody gangster things. They have all these kind of Godfather quotations. It's a bit of a television series from the 1970s called When the Boat Comes In, which is set in Newcastle, and which I think actually anticipates a great deal of what Peaky Blinders does. And it's, sort of ludicrously implausible in its plot lines. It doesn't bear much relation to Birmingham. I mean, there are these smogging gangs that exist in the late 19th century. There's obviously criminal activity. There are bookies. Carl Chin, who's the kind of local historian of Birmingham, who is himself from a family of bookies, I think originally illegal bookies, is in some ways the person at the origin of writing about these gangster families. But Carl Chin, in fairness, does say Peaky Blinders is not very realistic. And also, Birmingham criminals, insofar as they existed, were not very admirable people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's fascinating, isn't it, as you mentioned there, the distinction between what may be written by a historian and what may be produced by a television company and a screenwriter. In terms of Birmingham, at the turn of the 20th century, just before the First World War, how different? I mentioned earlier, what do you think if someone was taken from now and plonked back in Birmingham in the 16th century, what do you think they would see? If that same person suddenly went forward to Edwardian Birmingham, what kind of changes do you think that they would see, and how similar was Birmingham at that point to the city as it is now?
It's a city of incredibly dramatic change. So the Edwardian period, obviously, they'd see a city that's much bigger. They would see a city that's kind of on the cusp of being a centre of a certain kind of modernity. So I think one of the things that I ended up thinking about Birmingham, which wasn't where I started. So I started thinking, in fact, that the book would be more focused on earlier periods. And also, I started thinking about the one kind of most troubling question for historians, which is, does history exist really? Is there really any degree of continuity over time? And I'm still troubled by that question, in the sense that I'm still not certain in my own mind whether it's meaningful to write a history of Birmingham, and whether, a really kind of severe theoretical critic might say, that organizing people, because they happen to live at a certain point of longitude and latitude in historical terms, is as meaningless as if I were to write, you know, a history of people in the world whose names begin with B or something. I think there is a lot of discontinuity in Birmingham. I think also one of the things I ended up concluding is that Birmingham, although the cliche of Birmingham tends to be very much the 19th century city, i.e. the city of Joseph Chamberlain, and a Victorian city, and also a city which is often talked about in terms of kind of a very negative view of the 20th century. The 20th century as the century in which the Victorian structure of Birmingham was knocked down, particularly after 1945. In fact, Birmingham is primarily a 20th century city. So that's when it's biggest, that's when its industrial growth is fastest. And that, in some ways, is when it's the most important kind of epitome of certain kinds of things about Britain. I wanted to kind of rescue the 20th century by the time I finished writing the book, rescue the 20th century from the idea that it's just a kind of afterthought to Birmingham's history. And to say, well, it teaches us something, some things that are important about Britain generally. So I suppose those things would be, first of all, Britain is a modern industrial society. You know, I think we tend to think Britain's heyday generally comes about, I don't know, the 1850s. And we forget how much Britain as a whole goes on growing economically and how much is still, you know, big economic power in the 20th century. I think it changes our view, particularly of the interwar period, particularly the 1930s. So Birmingham, although it has unemployment, is always much less affected by unemployment than the North, the Scotland, Wales. So one of the key things about Birmingham in the 1930s is more than ever before, it's sucking people in from the rest of Britain. Mm. So I think I'm right in saying that 3% of the entire working population of Wales moved to the Midlands in the 1930s. And of course, very largely, they're moving to Birmingham. So, you know, one of the things I understood writing this book, which I think I haven't understood when growing up in Birmingham, was that because my family come to Birmingham in the early 60s, and because, as you can tell from my accent, I'm very kind of middle class, I always felt slightly ill at ease with especially my primary school. And yet, looking back, I can see that actually all the boys from my primary school, who were all kind of white, quite largely working class boys, they were actually all people whose fathers or grandfathers had come to Birmingham. They were all people who had been Scottish or Welsh or Northern, if you'd gone back just a generation or so. So I think there's that big transformation of Birmingham produced by migration before the Second World War. Birmingham in the Second World War is hugely important. So it's almost the kind of the industrial city of the Second World War, particularly a manufacturer of aeroplanes. And then, of course, it's the boom city of the 50s and 60s. So it's a city with incredibly high employment, almost oppressively high employment. You know, you can see that if you're a school leaver in Birmingham, it's actually quite depressing because, you know, your dad or your uncle or something says, I'll get you a job down the Longbridge factory. You start on Monday, you know, so you finish school on Friday and you got one weekend of freedom before you got 40 years of working on the track at Longbridge in front of you. So that it's a city of very full employment, very rapid economic growth. A city which, having been a conservative Chamberlainite city in the first half of the 20th century, the Chamberlains having effectively become conservatives, then becomes mainly a Labour city after 1945, although a particular kind of Labour city, a kind of right-wing, social democratic city, quite a lot of Tammany Hall, quite a lot of corruption in Birmingham. And I suppose that would bring me to the other point, which I wanted to make, which is that I think there's a lot of nostalgia now for the post-war period. So Eric Hobsbawm's big history of the 20th century talks about the golden age, 45 to mid-1970s. Tony Judd, again, historian of Europe, talks about the whole of Europe as having that kind of period from the end of the Second World War until the kind of economic downturn of the 1970s. I think historians are very influenced, even unconsciously here, by Thatcher. I mean, I think there's a very strong idea that Britain was a, you know, a nice consensual place before nasty Mrs. Thatcher came and spoilt it all. And I think looking at Birmingham complicates that view a bit, because on the one hand, Birmingham stands for everything that people regard as good about the post-war period. So for full employment, industrialism, you know, being an industrial rather than a service economy, and having a centrist but Labour centre-left type of administration. And yes, on the other hand, there are lots of things about Birmingham about which one might not feel nostalgic in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. So those would be, as I say, first of all, the fact that local government is often pretty corrupt. They would be that immigration often goes with racism. So Birmingham would be remembered for the Smethwick election of 1964, famously racist campaign that's technically just outside the Birmingham city limits, but very much associated with Birmingham, and for Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, which is given in Birmingham. So I think racial tension is a big feature of Birmingham. And I mean, I just can't describe what it was like growing up in Birmingham, even as a middle-class white person in a middle-class white area. I can remember when I wrote my chapter on immigration in post-war Birmingham, I called it Neighbours. And that comes from the slogan used by the Conservative candidate in the Smethwick election of 1964, where he uses what we now tend to call the N-word. And I can remember the sort of historical conventions changed in the process of writing this book. So originally I was going to start that chapter with the full quotation. And then, you know, my students can't use that word, Richard, anymore. Yeah. And I remember thinking at first, well, writing about Birmingham in the 1960s and 70s without using racist terms is like writing about Oliver Cromwell without using the word damnation, because these are words that one used to hear all the time on the street. You know, one used to hear, I've heard policemen use those terms. So that I think there are things I wanted, the thing I want to really sum up is to say there's this boom period in Birmingham, but it's not always a happy time. And of course, this is also the time that goes very much with Birmingham being architecturally a very kind of brutalist city, with the structuring of the city around the motor car, which means, of course, the structuring of the city around the driver, which means, in turn, the structuring of the city around middle-class, middle-aged men. So it's, you know, it's a city where there's kind of patriarchy is almost written into the structure of the post-war city.
Yeah. And I mean, just thinking of Birmingham now as compared to that post-war period, as you say, after the war, Birmingham transitioned very much from a conservative, a politically a conservative city, to more of a right within the context of the Labour Party, social democratic city. Now we're seeing Birmingham very much being a battleground between a particular type of modern conservative and the Labour Party. As well, what do you think the political feeling is in Birmingham and more broadly the West Midlands now, and how much do you think that it is related to the Brexit referendum and the relationship that had to car manufacturing, which of course has had such an important place in the history and the economy of Birmingham and the West Midlands?
That's an interesting question. So I think, first of all, I should say that Birmingham's relationship with conservatism is a kind of intermittent. So obviously Birmingham is a very liberal city in the 19th century. Joseph Chamberlain's initially a liberal. It then becomes conservative because of Chamberlain's sons, really. It then goes mainly Labour after 1945, but it's never a kind of red wall area. So that it's never an unqualifiedly Labour place. Yeah. So there are always times when the Conservative Party controls the council. There are always parliamentary seats that the Conservative Party wins. Edgbaston stays as a Conservative bastion, and right up to the 1980s, you'd have thought it inconceivable that Edgbaston would not be won by the Conservatives. The areas on the outskirts of Birmingham, the areas which increasingly the middle classes move to, as they get out of the city itself. So Sutton Coldfield, which technically is part of Birmingham from 1974, Soley Hull, which has never technically been part of Birmingham, those are the two safest Conservative seats in the country in 1979. But also, there are quite a lot of working class people in Birmingham that still go on voting Conservative in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly true, in fact, of car workers. One of the big questions about relatively recent history is why do working class people vote for Thatcher in 1979, which to a certain extent they do. And the answer to that is car workers. If you look at the constituencies that go Conservative in 1979 across the country, they're very much car areas. They're what sociologists in the 60s would have called affluent workers. And sociologists in the 60s say these people have instrumental voting patterns. They vote Labour because they think Labour suits them, but they're not loyal to Labour. And of course, the implication, which I think sociologists at the time don't fully explore, is these people might then decide later on that their interests lie in voting Conservative. And in 1979, quite a lot of them do, for complicated reasons, I think. I think partly they're voting against Labour Party pay control in the 1970s. Partly, in a funny kind of way, they're both simultaneously the kind of people who often go on strike in those big, or not big, but widespread unofficial strikes in the 1970s. And so on the one hand, I think they're often dissatisfied with their employer, which of course, in the case of British Leyland by now, is a partly nationalised employer, but also sometimes dissatisfied with their unions in ways that make them, curiously enough, turn to the right of their unions. I think racial tension in factories is also enormously important in the 1970s and is a reason for people moving to the political right. And I think in Birmingham, anti-Irish feeling is a very important element, especially after the Birmingham pub bombings at the early 70s, where on the one hand, a lot of Irish people, a very important part of the working classes, withdraw their support from Labour because they say, you know, Labour's behind British government policy in Northern Ireland at this stage. Of course they are. And a lot of non-Irish people acquire really kind of almost a pogrom mentality towards the Irish. So things like support for the restoration of the death penalty, very important part of the Thatcherite appeal in 79, she obviously never does restore the death penalty, is, I think, a big feature in Birmingham. So Birmingham is yo-yoing between the parties up until 1979. I think then, of course, very hammered after 79. So, I mean, I assume most people realise by about 1983 that voting Tory wasn't a good idea if you were a Longbridge worker. But then there's a curious feature about Birmingham, which is that I think actually it's exactly the opposite of the city that Theresa May and her advisors imagine it to be, this kind of Brexit city, this, you know, deep England, anti-metropolitan city. So first of all, a key thing about Birmingham is that it's a Blairite city. So now the MPs for Birmingham are overwhelmingly Labour. Mm-hmm. And the moment at which it acquires that overwhelmingly Labour support is actually 1997. Now, the one exception to that is the area around Longbridge, the Northfield constituency, where I think there's great bitterness about the closure of the Longbridge factory in the early 21st century, the final closure. And I think that becomes anti-European, partly because people blame BMW, which had been the last kind of significant owner of the Rover Group, as it had become. They do that very unfairly, because in fact, it's then bought by a bunch of British chancellors who turn out to run it into the ground in a way which is much worse than anything BMW had done. And also, I think that the protests about the closure of Longbridge often acquire an anti-Blairite dimension, because Blair is prime minister, and so it's very easy to present this as kind of the policy of this, you know, distant person from Islington. But there's a division in Birmingham, really. So that one area around Northfield is now, apart from Sutton Coldfield, I think the only Conservative constituency in Birmingham. All the other constituencies are Labour. So Birmingham is actually a place that should make the Labour Party feel quite hopeful, I think. And also, I think, a bit sceptical about the kind of Keir Starmer version, which is that, you know, the Labour Party has to embrace Brexit and has to talk with these kind of ostentatiously red wall accents to win people over. So I think Birmingham is a place that ought to give the Labour Party quite a lot of hope. Of course, it is true that the mayor of the West Midlands, Andy Street, is a Conservative. But I think his election is very misunderstood. And again, you get this slightly patronising reference to Birmingham, because there tends to be an assumption that there's going to be kind of one spokesman for Birmingham and this is going to be Andy Street. People forget the fact that Birmingham people, on the whole, voted against having the West Midlands mayor at all. B, the turnout for the mayoral elections is very small, much smaller than the parliamentary election. And C, Andy Street does not win Birmingham votes. If Birmingham votes alone had been counted, Andy Street would not be mayor. So it's much more a West Midlands phenomenon than a Birmingham phenomenon. I think, to turn to your last bit of your question about, you know, the West Midlands rather than Birmingham, I think there is now a kind of conservative ring around Birmingham, partly of places like Solihull, which have been conservative on and off for a long time. Partly, I think, the Black Country, where I think there's a kind of deeper pessimism and probably a more sort of red wally Brexit type of view. But I think Birmingham itself is, I mean, it's a slightly kind of trite way to finish, I suppose. But and it's always hard when you're writing a book that's partly autobiographical. It's partly, it's hard to know, you know, how much has Birmingham changed and how much have I changed? You know, I now go back to Birmingham as a visiting Londoner. I walk the streets of Birmingham as a 60-year-old man rather than a 16-year-old, which means, you know, things like violence don't affect me in the way that they did affect me when I was 16. But it seems to me that Birmingham is a much more kind of tolerant place, a place that has embraced multiculturalism. You know, one of the things I like about Birmingham is, you know, you ask a Sikh for directions and you get a reply in an incomprehensibly thick Brummie accent. So, you know, it feels like a place where immigration is now accepted as, or the result of immigration. We think people not immigrants anymore for a long time. But the on the whole, that kind of citizen of the worldness, which Theresa May denounced, is actually something that applies quite well in Birmingham. I think also, a key political division in Britain now is a very simple one, which is to do with higher education. So it seems to me that, you know, if you're asking about Brexit, if you're asking about political divisions in Britain now, they're very heavily to do with whether people went to university or not. And of course, Birmingham and the West Midlands is a big centre of higher education and a big centre, particularly of these two very distinguished universities, Birmingham and Warwick. And I think Birmingham University especially is now a focus for a kind of a particular kind of Birmingham. So, I mean, a lot of graduates, my sense is, now stay in Birmingham in a way they probably wouldn't have done one. So Birmingham is not a place where, on the whole, the university is educating local people, but it's sometimes turning them into local people. And, of course, Birmingham is located in Edgbaston, which used to be the heart of conservative Birmingham, and is now a Labour constituency and went Labour, as I say, in 1997.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Richard. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me about the book. If people want to find out more about the book, where should they go to purchase a copy? And if people want to find out more about you, the other work that you do, where should they go to find out more about the things that you're doing and the work that you're doing?
Well, I'm not very good at social media. So I also at this stage to say that, you know, you can go to my website, but I didn't have a website. But I do have the great advantage of having a very unusual name. So if you just Google Richard Viner, along with lots of abuse from my enemies, you will find me quite fast. So you'll find my website at King's College London, which is where I teach. And you will find, obviously, places to buy my books would just be Amazon. I'm also very struck by how many bookshops there are in Birmingham, actually. When I said to my publisher I wanted to write this book, they said very sniffily that it would only sell in one or two bookshops. And I realized in very typically London fashion, they hadn't actually bothered to establish how many bookshops there were in Birmingham. It turns out there are lots and lots of very dynamic bookshops. So I have done some signings around Birmingham. I think I probably will do some more in the future. But as I say, it's relatively easy to find me and my work just by doing a search on the web.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast
or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.